This episode of Munchkin Land is being brought to you by Loot Crate. Loot Crate is a monthly subscription box that's full of awesome geek and gamer items as well as pop culture gear. For less than $20 per month, you get 6 to 8 items that include a t-shirt, collectibles, and unique one-of-kind items. Join us as we celebrate the futuristic in July. Loot Crate has packed July's crate with items from some of pop culture's favorite prognostications of science and the future. Look forward to tomorrow with items from Rick and Morty, Futurama, Star Trek, Mega Man, Valiant Comics, and Star Trek, including a model, a figure, and don't forget the monthly tee and pin. Now here's the important part. You have until July 19th at 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific to subscribe to receive this month's crate. So make sure you head to www.lootcrate.com/munchkin, enter the code munchkin, and save $3 off any new subscription. It's that easy. Sit back, wait, relax, wait for the Loot Crate to arrive at your door. That's lootcrate.com/munchkin. Use the code munchkin, save $3 off your new subscription. I want to thank Loot Crate for sponsoring this episode of Munchkin Land. And this week, we've got another Sandy Peterson interview. In addition to talking about his new Kickstarter project, Dr. Brad Will sat down with Sandy to talk about Cthulhu, mythos, and a lot of pop culture stuff. And we figured instead of waiting and putting this out at some point in the far future, why not share it now?
Hey, this is Brad Will. I am here with Sandy Peterson. And
hello, this is Sandy Peterson.
And Arthur Peterson.
Hello.
And we are here talking about stuff for the Major Spoilers podcast. I wanted to talk, Sandy, about Lovecraft, Cthulhu, and just the general awesomeness of all that business.
Okay.
You were showing me an award you got as being one of the Lovecraftian guys, and you were saying that...
Yes, this was the Lovecraft Film Festival in Portland, Oregon, and each year they do, like, it's a big Lovecraft festival, and they give an award to people that they think have done... I don't know how they... do it. It was kind of a surprise and they gave it to me, but apparently it's for someone who has done something they view as great in the realms of Lovecraftiness. I'm not even sure what the right. And so they gave it to me, and the argument they made, which I guess they made it so I can't really say them, was that before 1980, almost no one had heard of Lovecraft. I know this well because every single person I knew had heard who knew about Lovecraft had learned about Lovecraft from me.
As
so,
did I.
Yeah. So yeah, and then yeah, you learned it from me too. A lot of people, I mean tons of people come to me and say I learned. So what their feeling was that by 1990, Lovecraft was kind of well known. Right? And by 2000, like Cthulhu was an internet meme. So what happened is they say is two things. There was the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, which people played and learned about Lovecraft. And the other was Stuart Gordon's movies, Reanimator, From Beyond, and so forth. And Brian Yuzna kept it on going with other things. And so the idea was that these two like channels of Lovecraftian stuff kind of filtered through geek culture and fan culture up into the mainstream culture and made Lovecraft known. So now he is a respected author or someone that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
To learn about, right?
So we all love Lovecraft now.
Yeah. Well, I do, yes.
Yeah. Well, everybody seems to... So this blows me away when you think about how something gets cultural significance. Now, Arthur, you grew up in a household, I'm assuming, that was steeped with Lovecraftian lore. Was that right?
Yes, that's an understatement.
He's wearing a great old one's shirt now, yes, right?
So I have a painting of Lovecraft on the wall in the place that someone else would have dogs playing poker or a seascape.
Right, right.
You've seen it now.
Yeah. It's,
there it is.
So how
Not does, Lovecraft, sorry.
Cthulhu. Okay, well, so this is even a thing. So why Cthulhu? Of all the stuff, right, why does Cthulhu become a ubiquitous part of our culture?
The reason that Cthulhu becomes the star is because it's quite clear what Cthulhu looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's like, what does Yogg-Sothoth look like? No one has really any idea.
Yeah.
And what a lot of the other creatures, there's no concrete nature. But Cthulhu, it's clear what he is. And also because the story, Call of Cthulhu, which, as you know, my game was named after. I wanted to call it Dark Worlds, right? But so be it. And but the story is really an amazing story because what you have is the threat is something is going to come and wipe out everything. It's like the ultimate annihilation, something that from Lovecraft's time wasn't a thing up until the 50s when nuclear annihilation became another possibility. But this is like the monster no one can defeat. When Cthulhu rises up, it's all over. And that is a concept in horror that is almost unique. You know? And since then, other apocalyptic horrors have started to appear, but they're kind of all knockoffs of Cthulhu in a sense.
Right.
So I think that's where the big green thing under the water, we know where he is. He's got a name we can kind of pronounce. And at first it was like, this is the cool thing to talk about that no one else knows. So it's like our secret in thing.
Yeah.
But Lovecraft didn't call it Cthulhu. He called it Yog-Sothothery. Yeah. He thought Yog-Soth was way more important.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. He called it Yog-Sothothery because, you know, Cthulhu is just one entity. I mean, I guess a race of entities down there, but Yog-Sothoth is, you know, an outer god way out there, coterminous with all time and space, so that was more important, you know, but it became Cthulhu.
Nobody wants a Yog-Sothoth plushie, for example.
Right. Right. But still Yog-Sothoth has its influence, in Call of Cthulhu, the classic Call of Cthulhu-type adventure from Lovecraft is the Dunwich Horror, which features Yog-Sothoth.
Yeah.
Right? Or the stories, like, From Beyond, the movie From Beyond, is really more of a Yog-Sothoth kind of activity. Other dimensions seeping through into our own, that kind of thing. It's all very, you know, there's... Yog-Sothoth is the ultimate Lovecraftian thing, but Cthulhu is just such a strong concept. And he's only in one story, right? It's one story about Cthulhu, and it's not even a novel.
He's mentioned in.
But he drops Shadows names. He drops time. Names in all the stories,
right? Yeah. Right.
But as a thing, there's one story, and he is a fabulous creation. And Lovecraft has other creations as fabulous, but I guess the pop mind can only comprehend one thing at a time. So,
So I am by profession a professor of American culture, specifically 20th century American popular culture, and. Something that runs counter to my notion is that one person could have a tremendous effect on American popular culture. And I'm not saying this to be flattering in any way, although maybe you'll take it that. But I can't imagine. But what if you had not pursued Call of Cthulhu as a project?
Well, we'd still have had Stuart Gordon, right? I mean, they're...
Yeah, but
that would have some effect, I imagine.
I would imagine, yeah. But Stuart Gordon's movies weren't. I mean,
none of them were Cthulhu.
They weren't at all.
But they were. They weren't the cause.
But they did put Lovecraft into the collective psyche to an extent.
Yeah, but
and we would still have had S.T. Joshi. Maybe not because who he's the guy that tried to make Lovecraft respectable among English professors.
Yeah,
right. And he may not have because one of the things that funded the new edition of Arkham Horror was. Oh, not Arkham Horror, of the Arkham...
Dagon. You're talking about Dagon?
No, I'm talking about the company, Arkham House.
Oh, yeah.
Arkham House,
one of the things that funded their republication of Lovecraft's manuscripts was royalties from Call of Cthulhu. So
really?
That may have squelched S.T. Joshi if they couldn't afford to do another edition, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They might have eventually done it, but there's... I don't know. Certainly without the burgeoning spread of people playing role-playing games and then Call of Cthulhu going in there and hitting everyone's fancy, I think there would have been Cthulhu would have been a lot less
major.
Another feature, though, there is, I guess I'm kind of patting myself on the back, is that one of the things that made it that way, I think, is that Call of Cthulhu was such a contrarian game to the other role-playing games. It does everything wrong and different and weird, right? And so that made it really stand out. So even people that didn't play Call of Cthulhu talked about it and had heard of it. Because, oh yeah, that's the game where you get crappier instead of getting better, where you lose stuff instead of gaining stuff, where the big fight, the goal isn't to fight monsters and take their stuff. The goal is to like avoid fighting monsters and avoid getting their stuff.
it feels like when you talk about it, it sounds like a satire of Dungeons and Dragons, right? But
it can play that. It almost, yeah.
Yeah, but there's nothing really satirical about it. I mean, it's also a really straight, cool adventure, like a fun, engaging adventure.
You're not playing
adventure.
A heroic guy who's better than ordinary. If anything, you're playing a guy who's worse off than regular humans.
Yeah.
You know, it's all these different...
You're just playing an average human. Usually.
But the thing is, if you want to play something that isn't just kill monsters, gain treasure, get better, then, like, Call of Cthulhu is not that experience, and there it is waiting for you.
Yeah, right.
You know? So I think that contrarian nature actually stimulated a lot of...
I was trying to remember what was in the market. And so I fell into Call of Cthulhu in 84, 85, like for the second edition. When the second edition came out, that's what got
Chill
me
Chill and Stalking the Night Fantastic and some other horror games.
Okay.
But they all... like they all reacted against Call of Cthulhu by making them like more conventional games. Where I can chill, you have a government agency that sends you out to fight the monsters, and you get better over time, and you keep it's like D&D with modern horror,
right?
And so you could play chill, but it's really kind of the same experience as D&D, except you know in modern times. But when you play Call of Cthulhu, it wasn't the same, and that can be seen as a good thing or a bad thing. But but everyone knew about it.
When did Paranoia hit the market? I mean, was the other
Paranoia
one
was after.
It was well after.
After Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Which is also. Now that actually is a parody on D&D.
Yeah, it certainly. Yeah, that's completely satirical.
Right. So it's a.
Yeah. But also tons of fun.
Oh, no, I'm not. I love Paranoia. I've had many discussions with Costigan about it, right? But great. The author, but. Name dropping right there in the new podcast.
Well done. Thank you. So when. So you
all the game designers of role playing games hung out in the 80s and would go to conventions and talk to each other. So it's not we were special.
Yeah, the convention scene was
there wasn't that many of us. Yeah, so.
That seems like I was doing
well. You were stuck at the tables too.
Yeah, so you'd be right next to somebody.
So when you had a break, you'd walk over to like the Paranoia booth, the West End Games, and say, "Hey, I'm Sandy Peterson." You go, "Oh, I like your game," because everyone plays everyone else's games.
Yeah.
So if you're a designer, you got to know the other key designers, and that was. Kind of cool.
That must have, I don't know. I'm just, see, I was going to conventions at that time, but purely from a consumer angle, right? And I was a bit of
a kid. Yeah, but I had an in because I'd done Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
So I would go to a designer and they would always either say, "Oh man, I love your game," or "Oh man, your game is so weird." Right? there was no one that just kind of like, "What game?" They always had an opinion about it.
So you were talking about, you were going to have a different title for Call of Cthulhu.
I thought, I wanted to call it, well, Call of Cthulhu is the name of a story. Why would Lovecraft's game be named after Cthulhu? Cthulhu wasn't the obvious thing for the game to be about.
So you didn't feel that either?
Lovecraft.
No, I thought, let's call it Dark Worlds and have a horror game.
Yeah.
So it was
my name before that was American Gothic, which is even worse, right?
Yeah.
But then they said, we want to name it after a story, and we think one of the most famous stories is Call of Cthulhu, which it is. So they named it that, and I said, "Oh, okay. Everyone know that Call of Cthulhu is about Lovecraft, I guess. So what the heck?"
Yeah, yeah. What a brilliant move, though. I mean, because it.
But the thing what you have to remember is that the guys at Chaosium didn't really know about Lovecraft either.
Right.
They wanted to do a Lovecraft game, but they didn't know about Lovecraft. They didn't respect or like Lovecraft. They thought he was a hack, just like almost everyone else did at that time. And they told right, but. They were smart guys, and they knew that to get a good... like, a lot of people, if they're doing a game of something they think is a hack author, they will just do a crappy version of it and say, "We'll just do it to like, get the saps to give us money," right?
Yeah.
But they said, "Let's make a good game, and we'll get Sandy Peterson, who loves Lovecraft. He's devoted to it. He'll do a good game. We can't, because we don't love Lovecraft. But he can."
Yeah.
And that was that's why they got me to do it for him. Because they knew I would love Lovecraft and try to do it right.
Because you had done Cthulhu Monsters in Gateway Bestiary.
Yes. Right? And in fact, the reason that I was a friend of theirs already, I phoned them up and do things. The reason that they set it in the 1920s, which in my own games I never did, right? I always figured Lovecraft was writing for the most modern audience he could.
Right.
He has modern, they use submarines and our airplane expedition and they discover all this. It's all cutting edge stuff for Lovecraft. He wasn't trying to be quaint and old, but the guys at Chaosium knew they had to have something in the game to hang their hat on that they would love, so they could be enthusiastic about the game. And what they picked was the 20s milieu because they thought the 20s was cool.
Yeah.
So that's why the 20s thing for them to be able to like the game. And then later on, they began liking it on its own merits, right? And even some of them even changed their position about. Lovecraft being terrible, right? But
I would hope.
Not yeah. Greg.
What?
Not Greg, apparently.
Not as much for Greg, no. But Charlie did.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was why the 20s came from. So because they kept trying to find ways. There's a lot of Cthulhu evolved weird way.
Yeah.
Because there was people that played it because they thought the 20s were cool. And whenever I have a convention, people ask me about, what do you think about people who play it outside the 20s and the sacred era? And I always say, I never play it in the 20s. And they're always shocked.
I've never seen my dad do it in other than the present day. So when he was playing, when I see him play a scenario in the 90s, it was set in the 90s, and now it's set in the 2010s because that's...
They said, what year is it? I said, it's 2016,
right? Every time. It's always like a horror, right? Because it's horror. Usually you set horror when you are, right?
Yeah.
Well, not if you're a 60s Hammer. But,
Yes.
But yeah, so I said it in modern times, and they were like, well, sometimes I said it in a different time. Like, I have a campaign I run that takes place
the future
in 1946 and things like that, but for specific reasons.
Yeah.
But I never was the 20s guy, and they're usually shocked by that. And usually I think they're shocked because they aren't Lovecraft fans. They're fans of horror and again of the 20s thing, which is fine. I have no objection to that. But I know it sounds weird for the guy that did a game with all this 20s action to not care about the 20s action.
Well, no, that's brilliant though. I mean, because it is completely, you don't need that. It doesn't need to be in the 1920s.
It doesn't rely on it.
Yeah.
When I did play in the 20s, back in the 80s, I did play games in the 20s, but I never used the 20s stuff. I did, cause I didn't care about it. I would say, well, you're getting a car and going here. You're going to get in a plane and go here. You know, and they say, what about a Zeppelin? Sure. Take a Zeppelin. What do I care? Right. The point is that there's a horrible monster. Not that there's not that you're riding a Zeppelin and eating Delmonico steak on the way.
Right. Yeah. But somehow that accoutrement works for somebody.
Some people love that, right? Yeah. But I love having it in modern times so they know they're kind of screwed over because with all the power of the modern age, this can't defeat the monsters and it's like we're doomed.
And I think it's also important that there is that level of familiarity. You can say
something and they don't have to figure out, can we buy a gun?
Yeah.
You know, I say, well, you know, it's England in 2016, so probably not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's your place that's getting ransacked or they're in your town. Yeah. They're here with you right alongside you.
There's a lot of things I don't have to say. I say this company has a government contract, so they know that there might be some kind of agency that will get on a watch list if they bother with it, right? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's actually very convenient for shorthand.
Yeah. Now let's talk about another project of yours, and I was shocked when I found out first that you were involved in Doom. I didn't know. I played Doom.
I mean, no secret about it.
Rapidly, yeah, but as a fan, it's shocking to me that I didn't make the connection because I loved Call of Cthulhu. I loved Doom.
Oh,
and it never occurred to me that there was the same guy involved in both of these projects.
To be fair, there was other people involved in making
Doom,
but yeah. I did most of the levels in both Doom and Doom 2. I named the monsters. I named the levels. I figured out the hit points of the... I did a lot of the design work.
Yeah.
You know, I was one of the first guys that actually was a level designer in the industry. They didn't really have that job before then. So
that game feels, I mean, this is conceptually so different from Call of Cthulhu, where you just go in, you just dominate those monsters, and that's the joy of it, right?
But they're scary, and eventually they pull you down, right?
Yeah, they always pull you down. Yeah.
Well, not all of them do you dominate. When the cyber demon comes out, or one of those things, then it's going to be bad.
Duck for cover.
So it does have the ultimate thing. Well, one of the things I tried to do in it, I actually did elements of horror in it. I mean, it starts horror anyway, but like my signature thing to do in a Doom level was you walk into the room and there's no monsters. There's just a pedestal with like the BFG or something on it.
Yeah.
And a spotlight. And you know, when you pick that thing up, all hell literally is going to break loose. Right.
The BFG,
and
by
you
the
just
way,
know,
is
and everyone is like creeped out and like, the official name of the BFG is the Big Fun Gun. I just want to make that clear.
Okay. All right. Fun is good.
Big Fun Gun.
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
the awesome cool gun from there. Yeah. I also want to talk a little bit about Chaosium and your recent rescue of Chaosium.
Who?
Yeah. Well.
Yes. Well, what happened is that Chaosium was floundering, basically with trying to fulfill the Call of Cthulhu 7th edition Kickstarter. And it had been like, I mean, I'm not saying that it took me 2 years to do Cthulhu Wars, right? Or I guess a year and a half. So it was a tough thing to bring out Cthulhu Wars, but Cthulhu Wars was kind of a groundbreaking game. It had bigger figures than anyone had done before. It had all this stuff that hadn't been done. And not only had it not been done by anyone, it hadn't been done by me or by the factory I used. So it was like, there was a learning process. So while I'm not patting myself on the back for taking a year and a half, we did get it done.
Yeah.
Call of Cthulhu 7th edition is a reprint of a game they've done 6 times before, and it was taking 2 years to get it out, and it wasn't out yet. And what happened is that Greg Stafford and I got ourselves, you know, we were on the board of directors, and we essentially said, and we kept digging further and further into what was going on with Chaosium, and we kept being less and less sure they're going to be able to to do the game.
And to actually bring the physical copies.
Then we
actually
found out that Chaosium was essentially out of money, and it was relying on sales of current games to do it. And we'd like, oh my gosh. And then I felt one of the things that was triggered with me, because I was already being blamed by people for them not publishing Call of Cthulhu 7, though I had nothing to do with it.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I was not responsible for publishing it. I didn't write the text to 7th edition. I was just the author of the first edition in 1981.
If you're the main, your name will never get detached from it, though.
Yeah. No, of course not. But there's nothing. But I was helpless to make it come out sooner.
Yeah.
So that was a problem. And second was, it was kind of dragging down the whole crowdfunding thing in general, that it was not going well. There was a lot of negativity towards Chaosium. And that there was, so here's negativity towards a project that I had originally authored, that is about Lovecraft, and it's on crowdfunding, and all of this, I mean, from a purely business model, and it's not just that, there's also emotion and self-esteem, but like, it was the worst situation possible for me. So I decided that Chaosium needed a new management, and along with Greg.
Yeah.
And we had several different people who were all offering to, we didn't want to run Chaosium. Because, I mean, I have a whole company to run besides Chaosium, Peterson Games. And Greg didn't want to run Chaosium because he wants to retire and write novels and ride horses in Northern California.
So, a noble pursuit.
So yes. We had several different people who all were offering to buy Chaosium. And we didn't talk to any of them until after we basically had ousted Charlie Crank and said, we're going to take over and see. And that's when we found out how deep in the hole Chaosium was. And we're like, oh my God. I'm not sure it would have lasted another 6 months.
Really?
Seriously. Yeah, it was in really bad shape.
The books were not going to be delivered.
There was back taxes they hadn't paid. There was all kinds of things. They hadn't paid their authors for years sometimes.
Wow.
Decades in some cases. It was really, there was a tangled weave web that had been woven. So, I mean, it had always gotten out of those things in the past, but past performance is no guarantee of future value, right?
Yeah.
So we discussed it, Greg and I, and decided and then the guys at Moon Design, basically the deal was that they would come in and they would, in return for Chaosium and like a pittance, basically, that they would get 7th edition published.
Nice. Yeah.
And plus we already were tied to them because they owned the Glorantha license, which both Greg and I had done things with.
Yeah. Oh, so that
so,
wasn't.
And owned. So it was actually bringing Glorantha back to Chaosium in a sense.
Okay. So yeah, I had not realized that. And this was.
But when Greg left Chaosium in the 70s, in the 90s, then he'd spun off Glorantha and it had been bought by Moon Design.
And Glorantha is the world of
RuneQuest.
Glorantha
is the world of White Bear Red Moon, of King of Dragon Pass, of RuneQuest, of
the forthcoming gods.
There's yes. comic books and novels and computer games and everything, right? And so those guys came in, and then bringing Glorantha back to Chaosium was kind of a big deal because Chaosium used to have a bunch of games.
Yeah.
You know, they had Stormbringer and they had Hawkmoon and they had Call of Cthulhu and they had Pendragon and they had Superworld and they had Worlds of Wonder and they had Glorantha and they had all these things and they gradually had been shedding them all until they were really kind of down to just Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
And Nephilim.
Well, yeah, but I think I said Cthulhu Wars. I meant Call of Cthulhu. Yeah. And so what happened is like we're trying to like reaccrue some of that stuff. I'm still on the board of directors, but I don't have any power over Chaosium anymore. The guys, Moon got a 51%.
So you fixed it and then dropped the mic and walked away.
Well, I'm still involved because I am an advisor that they actually value the advice of at times. And also because,
yeah.
Yeah. And also really because, good and also because I'm doing this game, God's War, coming up, going after the God's War, which is licensed from them to use their world for another strategy game. So there's ties there. So they kind of want to keep me happy. Plus, they don't want to be bad mouthing the new 7th edition Call of Cthulhu.
Right.
So I have.
That's a good idea.
Moon Design is a really great group of guys, anyway.
Yeah, they are a great group of guys.
We're good friends with them.
But if something went horribly wrong, then I kind of have them over a barrel because if I went online and said, oh, the new Call of Cthulhu is a sham and no one should buy it, which I don't for a minute think, by the way, then they would be really sad, right? And there'd be nothing they could do about it except be sad.
Yeah.
But I think it's actually a pretty good thing. I like Mike Mason and Paul Frick, the guys that did it. And
excellent. We should talk for a minute at least about Cthulhu Wars.
Let's talk about Cthulhu Wars.
Which is on my list of best games ever.
Thanks.
Golly, it's good.
It reinvented me.
Yeah.
What happened is that I had left computer games, and I had failed doing a small iOS company, and then I was not sure what to do, and I said, well, I'm going to go get a job being a designer and working for the man in India or somewhere. They actually made me an offer in India, of all places.
Wow.
It was a great offer, actually. It was a fabulous opportunity. Before I go, I'm going to do one last hurrah and do my game that I want to do, because all the time working for computer games, I'm not doing my own stuff, actually. I'm doing stuff for someone else. Someone else picks the topic. That's how it is in the computer world, right? You don't pick your own topic, right? And so I said, I'm going to do my own game. I want to do like a different take on the Cthulhu mythos. Instead of heroic investigators against the monsters, it's going to be Cthulhu comes back and he's got all his stuff. And he's, you know, and he's all his power. So the only thing that can stop him is something else just as dire as he is. So I just went, we're going to have all these things. And I wanted to have figures. I made the things 28 millimeter so I could use them in Call of Cthulhu.
Right.
I wanted to have figures for all these monsters. And now I have them. right. So I did this game and I kickstarted it, and it was fabulously successful, as you know.
Yeah.
And so much so, that, I mean, astonishingly so, that I had to call the guys in India and cancel the job. I got to stay here and manage this. And then, so I thought it was going to be my swan song, my last thing ever. Then I was going to go off and do, you know, iPhone games for an Indian company. But it turned out that instead it was like the rebirth, the phoenix from the ashes. And now I'm back and I'm constantly designing board games. And it's
awesome.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And Cthulhu War, I love Cthulhu Wars, you know, a lot.
Do you, I mean, I guess you have a sense of how deeply those of us who really like that game really like that game. I mean, that seems to be...
I am a fan of Cthulhu Wars, the game.
Yeah.
I like playing it still. And this is not true of all my games. I don't... Like, I do a game, and there's a lot of games I've done that I'm proud of that I do not want to go back and play 3 years after it came out.
Yeah,
I played it a lot before it came out and after, and you get sick of games.
Yeah.
Even if they're good games. But Cthulhu Wars is not one of those. It still has new things, even for me. And I still go over there and look at my shelf that you're seeing here of all the figures.
Yeah.
And pull out some of the figures and say, man, I did a good job on Yacht. He looks fabulous, you know.
But there's so many expansions.
But that's why I'm always online on Board Game Geek and stuff talking about it, because I still like that game and I'm keen on it. And I still evangelize for it, just even though it's already out, just because.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lincoln,
I want everyone to see what I see, but there's guys like you who see what I see, yeah. You know, yeah. and Arthur is also the same way.
Yeah, my brothers and I have played probably.
We still uncover new clever things that you can do. Yeah, that we hadn't thought of.
Since before the Kickstarter in 2013, because it was in development before that, of course, we've probably now played hundreds of games of Cthulhu Wars with various expansions, and I'm pretty sure we've seen. There's still things that we'll see. A particular set of expansions in play and see something happen that we haven't really seen much. You're like, oh, wait, that was a cool strategy or tactic, right? You know, which makes it hard to balance.
What was the game about just this week? Something that was some bizarre strategy that they
that must have been with Lincoln.
Maybe it was Jonathan.
Oh, yeah. No, that wasn't the most unusual thing. When Jonathan, somebody won the game as Cthulhu in the middle of an action phase, which we've seen
before.
That
never happens, right?
But it's rare.
Yeah, right.
He did it by awakening an independent great old one. And getting an Elder Sign, and it happened to be a 3-point Elder Sign. He had his 6 spell books, and so he won. It was just a rare thing. He wasn't expecting to win. He was expecting to get his great independent great old one.
Yeah.
You know, but he was so close anyway that he said, well, okay.
So this, for me, with all the different combinations, all these different boards, all these different expansions and different factions you can play, Cthulhu Wars feels more like a game system to me than a game. You know, like it's... You can put these pieces together in so many different ways.
Right. Different maps, different...
Yeah.
Tons of different people you can play. Mercenary type units with the neutrals and independents. Other types of expansions like the High Priest. Yeah, there's a lot of even types of expansions. It is more like a system in that sense.
Yeah, yeah.
There's physical things that make the game fun for me. One of the things that I love about it and I get just dinged all the time for the giant figures. But one of them is that when I pull out Cthulhu Wars to play with it, it's like when I was a kid and I got the big bag of plastic dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite toys as a kid. And ever since I read Lovecraft from the early age, I wanted to have a bag of plastic Cthulhu monsters.
Yeah.
And so I had to make my own, I guess.
Yeah.
But I love that feeling of looking at the cool monsters, right? And it's impossible to hold up, like, shove Niggurath and Cthulhu and not go rawr and have them fight, right? It always happens.
The one I always see when I bring the game out to people who haven't seen it, they always grab Haster and then plump it down on the board with real vigor and gusto. Oh,
yeah.
You know,
because Haster's a striking figure.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, is that one of the things that Cthulhu Wars does really well. If you go to a convention or something and you lay Cthulhu Wars out on your table, it draws attention. They're like, what's this? If they haven't heard of it, they want to know.
Yeah.
And then they might be sad when they hear about the price, but but it looks really cool. It delivers on the coolness, I think.
Yeah, and then the second factor, once the visual part of it has worn off,
you realize how asymmetrical it is and how much strategy there is, and there's like a surprising amount of depth for what is really a pretty simple in terms of rules.
Yeah, the rules are not too deep.
And I play complex games. I mean, I play Here I Stand and all these dreadful war games.
Europe Engulfed.
But Europe Engulfed, right?
One of my favorites.
But Cthulhu Wars isn't, it gets its depth by a different route.
Yeah.
When we do demos and play games at conventions, we teach the rules in about 10 minutes. The full rules.
Yeah.
Basically. And they're good to go.
Yeah.
And of course, they bungle their way to victory, right? But
Well, the learning curve is a little steep. I mean, the learning curve for strategy is a little steep.
Strategy is steep, yes.
Yeah.
But I don't fear it is a flaw in a strategy game to have new players be beaten by experienced players. That's kind of how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, that's...
Because if everyone had an equal chance to win all the time, then, like, something's wrong with your strategy.
We could flip a coin and then call that a game, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about Cthulhu Wars that the only way I can express it is to say that it creates or scratches a little itch in some part of my brain that other games don't hit somehow. You know, like, it just feels like there's some kind of challenge going on there that doesn't happen elsewhere for me.
One person, what he said he liked about it is that you felt like you were overpowered when you played Cthulhu Wars. Like, you were a cosmic monster breaking the rules, and if you could just get your stuff organized the way that the game lets you do it, you would obliterate those dudes, and you're totally unfair.
Yeah.
And you are.
Yeah.
Everyone has some awful game-breaking thing that makes them just unfair and terrible.
You're embarrassingly overpowered.
You're embarrassingly overpowered. And the way I balanced it was never to nerf a unit to make it weaker. It was always to make someone else stronger. Like, oh, you beat him. Okay, we'll make you stronger.
Right. Yeah, usually most of the time anyway. When a faction was winning too much, well, everybody else just gets stronger. That's how often. What faction spell books could we boost in other things so that they will win as much as this one, right? Yellow signed right after the Kickstarter, because things weren't completely finished at that time. We were still balancing. Yellow sign was winning all the games. So basically everybody got better.
Nice.
It didn't make Yellow Sign worse. Yellow Sign is just as mean as it ever was.
Right. And that's a great policy, because we know how often that happens in other venues. Well, in computer games, obviously.
Yeah.
And then the community just...
I did it myself in computer games, right? So I know exactly how it works.
Yeah, and the community cries when that happens, right? Yeah. Oh, you nerfed my guy.
Right.
But Destiny
faction. But no one complains
when
you make Groth better.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, okay, cool. I'm just as cool as I was. Now Groth's better, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
there are occasions when we had to nerf something because that was the only way to do it, but it was rare.
We'll pretend like it never happened.
Yeah, philosophically, our goal is always to make you cooler, not weaker.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's part of the fun. But then the fun. So that maybe I don't know if that's the itch that is scratching for you. You know, I know that my players, my main groups of playtesters, had never read Lovecraft, didn't like horror movies, didn't know anything about the Cthulhu mythos. Okay. I mean, they heard the name Cthulhu,
right,
and they love playing the game. So it's scratching something for them too. I mean, I know Cthulhu fans, it's fun just to pull out a Shoggoth, right? But these guys who aren't Cthulhu fans, it's doing something for them too.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, in the back of the book, I try to describe the personalities of the factions. I got my initial stab at those personalities from the guys who didn't know about Lovecraft and said, well, this guy seems like a scavenger and a opportunist, and he feels like a bully in this one, right?
Nice,
like a fungus infection.
Yeah.
I just took it from, and they didn't know who Subnigarath was. They just said, this feels like a fungus infection that spreads and spreads, and you can't stamp it out because it's always necrophagy in your areas and avatar in your other areas, and you can't make them go away.
And they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And if you kill every single one of their guys on the map for 10 power, they all come back at once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a brilliant game, and thank you for bringing it to the world. And thanks for the interview.
It was really fun to design. It was one of my most fun. Not every game is fun to design. This one was fun to design, and it just flowed from the start.
Yeah.
Which not every game does. Some games I have to chug through and make it work. This one, from the start, it hung together. I don't know what. Maybe it's Cthulhu was inspiring me or something, right? But it,
that was it.
It felt otherworldly almost.
The stars were aligned.
The stars were aligned. It was time for this game to be there. Or maybe it was just that for 20 years I'd had a lot of pent-up Cthulhu stuff in my mind I hadn't had it out before.
Yeah.
And it all came out at once.
Well, it came out very nicely. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for the interview and the time. This has been a ton of fun. Thanks, Arthur. Thank you, Sandy. And I guess we'll hand it back to the folks at Major Spoilers. So have a good night.
Thank you.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.